You'll find an authoritative witness to the gospel of salvation by grace alone in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Galatians. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest, Dr. Andrew Das. The Concordia Commentary on Galatians is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or you can read an excerpt at issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Galatians, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin on this Friday afternoon, the 19th of September. We continue our series on important philosophers. This one today, he is regarded as the father of modern philosophy. And I think he even regarded himself in this way. René Descartes decides he's going to start from scratch. He's going to write about philosophy and about the questions he wants to answer as though no one had ever written about them before. That is a rather ambitious undertaking, but his influence is pervasive. Even if you don't know the name or you're only passingly familiar with the name Descartes, his influence is pervasive today. Some ideas that we carry around we don't even know came from him. Joining us for part three of our five-part weekly series on important philosophers, today 17th century French philosopher René Descartes, Dr. Angus Manouge. He's professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. Dr. Manouge, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me again.
He's called the father of modern philosophy. He might have even seen himself that way. Where do we see Descartes' influence in his thinking today among us?
Basically, in the individualistic idea that a person with the power of his own reason can figure out important truths for himself. He doesn't have to depend on previous authorities or appeal to scripture, but that he can figure it out for himself. And that was really the foundation of Descartes' new method, to get away from the scholastic authorities, and so much so that he modeled it by being a bit of a recluse and doing philosophy in a rather antisocial way. You hole up in a room, and it's you and your mind, and you figure things out, and you demonstrate that they're true.
That's a pretty big idea, isn't it?
It really is. And, I mean, of course, the scholars have shown that he exaggerates his being an innovator. It's very clear that he was influenced by the Jesuits, who he had been a student under, and he did carry around Aquinas' Summa Theologica. But he was contemptuous of the past. He said, no, I'm going to give up reading these scholastics. And he thought one day, when he was alone in the small stove-heated room in 1619, that he would come up with a brand new, improved method for acquiring human knowledge. Pretty extraordinary.
Just to stay in the 21st century for a moment, and his influence in that, because that is an idea that, people would hardly consider it thinking if they weren't following that particular presupposition. What's good about it? What isn't good about it?
I guess what's good about it is that we accept the fact that reason is a gift of God in our vocations. He does want us to use our reason to serve our neighbor. There isn't any book of armaments or book of auto mechanics in the Bible. We're told to love our neighbor, but how we do it is something that we discover using our reason, and that really is part of our stewardship call. That's something that's very good. But of course, as time goes on and we become better and better at this, we start to lean on our own understanding and perhaps think that reason is all that we need. And you see within Descartes' system increasingly a deistic, mechanistic picture of nature that develops autonomously. And Descartes is often accused of being a deist. And certainly whether he is or not, his system encourages it. And it also encourages people, therefore, to use their reason to reject revelation or to qualify revelation because it doesn't make sense to them. And it's interesting that the next rationalist along, Spinoza, who was very influenced by Descartes, was really the father of higher criticism and subjected the scriptures to all kinds of rational critique.
The probably phrase for which he is best known, if not best understood, is, "I think, therefore, I am." Do we rightly get what he was saying in that little axiom?
I think probably not. A lot of people hear this and they parody it and they say, oh, well, perhaps I can say I eat, therefore I am, or I drink, therefore I am. And in fact, Descartes is very careful with his starting point. The context is that before him, you had really a resurgence of skepticism. Michel Montaigne had gone back and was exploring the same kind of skepticism as the ancient skeptics who took over after Aristotle's time in the academy. And they had made it seem very uncertain that we could know anything. Descartes uses his famous method of doubt, where he imagines, suppose there's an evil deceiving genius, deceiving me as much as he can. He wants to see if there's anything which it's actually impossible rationally to doubt. And he's willing to doubt not only that the outer world exists, perhaps it's all a dream fed into his mind from this genius, rather like in the Matrix movie. But he's even willing to doubt that he has a body, because certainly it's possible he'd have all the experiences of having a body, even though he doesn't have one. But he realizes the mind is different. He says that thought, now I've found something that really cannot be detached from me. And this is because of the subjectivity of thought. That in order to have thought, you have to have a thinker. Unlike the body, right, somebody's arm or leg could be attached to their body or it could not. But when you think about thoughts, the idea of an ownerless thought, a thought that nobody is having, doesn't seem to make any sense. A thought is always someone's thoughts. So even if all his thoughts are false and he's being deceived, still he must exist as the thinker of those thoughts. That's his real argument. And I think it's a lot more interesting than perhaps people realize.
So he is making... He's essentially trying to lay a foundation for saying, how do I know I exist?
Yeah, he says that, you know, his beliefs have developed sort of haphazardly, you know, as he has grown up. And what he wants to do is to raise that belief system down to the ground and then rebuild on a certain foundation. The idea is to have a foundation of indubitable certainty. And he does this not because he's a skeptic. He wants to rebuild all the things that he formerly believed in, such as an external world and such as God's existence and so forth, but to base it on a foundation of absolute certainty.
Let's talk a little bit about his life. What do we need to know about his... You mentioned Jesuit influence. What else do we need to know about René Descartes?
He's a real maverick. He never was a university professor. Only occasionally was he a teacher. He was a private, served as a private tutor. And in fact, that was quite literally the death of him when Queen Christiana of Sweden insisted he get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to give philosophy lessons, and he died of the cold. So he never was a typical academic. He actually served in the army. And he is also very odd in that he was rather reclusive. He lived at many places where he wouldn't provide people the address, except for those people that he wrote to. Half of Descartes' works is actually his letters to a very select number of people who he thought were worth bothering with. And unfortunately, he didn't seem to spend a whole lot of time talking to other people. So very unusual there, and very unusual as well in his dismissal of previous authorities, where he said at one point he hadn't opened a volume of scholastic philosophy in 20 years, and he was rather proud of the small size of his book collection.
Now, I wonder, and I've wondered about this with several philosophers that we have talked about and there are many that we don't have time to talk about. He was a student of mathematics. And I've often wondered, and I guess I want your thoughts on it, why do we often find those two coming together, the philosophical disciplines of mathematics, wherever it is, ancient or more modern, as it is in the case of Descartes, and philosophy?
Yeah, because you see the relationships between abstract ideas, and you realize that you can prove general conclusions. I mean, Descartes, like Plato, was not very impressed with the senses. He pointed out they could deceive. But he noticed that in mathematics, you could start from apparently self-evident axioms and then, by trustworthy rules, prove all kinds of impressive results. And he was hoping that in metaphysics, one could apply a similar method to find out the basic nature of reality. He wanted a metaphysics that would be the foundation of physics. So he needed to know what matter was, and he concluded that it's this extended stuff that you could describe, in effect, by geometry and motion. And he also needed to know what the investigator was, what mind is. So he focuses his metaphysics on trying to prove the nature of matter and the nature of the mind. And he does it according to a paradigm of really mathematical proof, as he thinks of it.
You mentioned that much of his works are his correspondence. How would you describe his works? What would you say the scope of them are?
Well, a lot of it really is on his new method. He has works like, you know, Rules for the Direction of the Mind, or Discourse on Method, and the Principles of Philosophy, which goes into philosophy here, includes things that we would consider physics. So, for example, he had the idea that you could explain all causation by contact, because he thought wherever there was space, there was matter. There couldn't be empty space. He actually denied the whole idea of a vacuum. And if one thing affects another thing, it must be through some medium. And so you have the plenum, where the whole physical world is just full of stuff. So he does work as well on the connection between mind and body. He's very interested in physiology. He dissected cadavers, and he studied optics and the eye and things like that. Very wide-ranging student. But he also wrote just so beautifully and simply. And the Discourse on the Method was stunning because it was written in French. And so he was also concerned to write more accessibly than his predecessors at times, although many of his works are in Latin.
You mentioned earlier the question of whether or not he's a deist in the end, but he does develop perhaps the most simple argument for the existence of God. How strong it is another question, but he simply argues only the existence of God can explain my idea of God. Take us into that.
Yeah, at first sight, it sounds like it's just Anselm's idea again. In the 11th century, St. Anselm said, you know, that if you have the idea of that than which none greater can be conceived, the greatest conceivable thing, then that would have to come from this greatest conceivable thing, and so God exists. Now, Descartes' argument is actually along those lines, but it's significantly different. Descartes says that he has this idea of an infinite, perfect being. What he does to supplement Anselm's account is to say, well, you have to have a causal account of where this idea would come from. And the principle is that there has to be at least as much reality in the cause as in the effect. He doesn't deny that you can have fictional ideas, like you get the idea of a unicorn from horses and rhinoceroses. But there has finally to be something real in the cause that would account for the idea. And so in the case of this idea of an infinite perfect being, he says really there are only three alternatives. Either the idea comes from me, or it comes from the world, or it comes from a being who really is infinite and perfect. And it can't come from me, because I'm afflicted with doubts and limitations. I know full well I'm imperfect and finite. And the same thing is true of the world around me. I don't see anything which qualifies as perfect and infinite. And so if those are the only three alternatives, and two of them are clearly insufficient, he argues that the idea of God must come from God himself.
Dr. Angus Manoj is our guest. It's part three of our five-part weekly series with him on important philosophers. We're talking about 17th century French philosopher René Descartes. Another one of his ideas, innate knowledge, when we come back.
If any former evangelicals are hearing me speak right now, I want to assure you, you don't have to be a homeless Christian. If you would go to issuesetc.org, look on their website, you'll find a list of churches. Find one close to you and attend that church. There, you can receive the true gospel, you don't have to be a homeless Christian, and they will not call you a backslider.
To find a church near you, go to issuesetc.org and click Find a Church.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
No matter the size, big or small, RP Lumber can deliver it all. From pickups to one-tons to box trucks and booms, everywhere you look, you see blue. RP Blue. RP prides itself in customer service. RP will deliver quality products to your home, business, or job site, and you can be sure of timely delivery on clean trucks with courteous drivers. So when you think of service, think blue. RP Blue. With over 50 local community locations, for 37 years, RP Lumber.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Trinity Lutheran, Brooklyn, New York. Hope Lutheran, Birmingham, Alabama. Our Savior Lutheran, Paradise, California. St. John Lutheran, Ray, Michigan. Peace with Christ Lutheran, Fort Collins, Colorado. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Kimberling City, Missouri. The Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Salinas, California, St. John's Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin, and St. John's Lutheran, Colton, California. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Issuesetc.org and click support. The Issues Etc. 300. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. Angus Manoj is our guest. It's part three of our five-part weekly series on important philosophers today, 17th century French philosopher René Descartes. It's one of those things you're going to learn when you get to college, or you learned when you were back in college. You start being exposed to the great thinkers from before when you were born, people who thought through the ideas that maybe you're struggling with there in the classroom, at the college or the university. Sometimes those thinkers will greatly benefit you as a Christian, and sometimes they will challenge the very foundations of the Christian faith. That's what LCMSU is all about, and they got a conference coming up January the 5th through the 7th at St. Louis University in St. Louis, Missouri. It's for college and university age kids, and the theme of the upcoming conference in January is called Taboo, What We Haven't Been Talking About, taking up some taboo subjects for discussion and conversation. Now, you can find out more about Taboo, What We Haven't Been Talking About, January 5th through the 7th, 2015, at St. Louis University, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. That's the Taboo Conference from LCMSU at St. Louis University, January 5th through the 7th. Dr. Manoj, one of the big ideas, and he apparently had only big ideas, one of the big ideas that Descartes actually had was that of innate knowledge. How would you describe it?
Basically, at that time, many philosophers subscribed to the idea of the natural light, and it basically is a sort of religious idea at base, that we do have some basic knowledge built into us at birth. And so Descartes and other rationalists would argue that the principle of identity, anything is identical with itself, and the principle of non-contradiction, you can't have something and its opposite at the same time, are not things that we learn from experience. They're things already built into us and through which we evaluate our experience. And I think, as well, the ideas of infinity and perfection. He says he doesn't get the idea of infinity by denying the finite, or the idea of perfection by denying imperfection. He says, rather, he would only be able to understand his own finitude and imperfection because he had this prior knowledge of God's attributes. And this is rather like something Pascal says, you know, where he says that we're like deposed kings. Our ability to see ourselves as fallen, finite, frail, and all the rest of it, seems to depend on a prior knowledge of a higher standard, which Descartes would argue is our inbuilt knowledge of God.
How would you describe his influence during his lifetime and then afterward?
Well, during his lifetime, some of his work was rather unpopular, and he either didn't publish it or had to be withdrawn. He actually had a heliocentric view, which he decided he wouldn't publish after the condemnation of Galileo. I didn't want to face that kind of trouble. His ideas, though, were very influential even in his lifetime because they provoked a series of objections and replies, especially his work on the mind and body, because he has this radical dualism of a mental thinking thing, a substance that's not in space. And then you have matter, which is located in space. And, of course, then people said, well, how is it that they can interact? How can this mind, which is not in space, interact with physical bodies that are? And so on that issue and many others, you have a whole collection of objections. And if you get a complete edition of the Meditation, you will always get the objections and replies. And there are several sets of these from the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, from Father Marimus Cern, who put together a number of these objections, and from Princess Elizabeth, who was a very acute critic of some of his views. So he actually is credited with beginning the whole tradition of peer review. Very influential as well on all the later philosophers. It's very clear in the writings of Spinoza or Locke, even though Locke was an empiricist. They are all influenced by Descartes.
I wonder about his people who are indebted to him in one sense, that is, his method that says we're sufficient in our own reason to examine the situation and draw conclusions and arrive at truth, ultimately, in that sense. People who are indebted to him for that now have gone far beyond him in their mechanistic view of the world. I mean, the naturalist, as we would call him today, Dr. Manoj, would not even permit that there's a mind, an immaterial.
Yes.
They would say that's just another, it's another rather mysterious but still ultimately explainable result of pure physical causes.
Right, and that's the tragic legacy of Descartes, is that he create a picture of the physical world as a machine, but later thinkers, and one thinks immediately, you know, in before the French Revolution, of some of the encyclopedists like Julien Offray de Lemaître, who wrote the book L'Homme Machine, Man the Machine, and Baron de Holbach, who said that basically there is no free will because human beings are themselves just machines living in a world of machines. And so the horrible thing that happened to the Cartesian legacy is the same system that he had used to understand the physical world was then applied to man. And so now what happens to the soul? What happens to the image of God? What happens to all of these special characteristics, the moral characteristics, the dignity, the human worth of individuals?
I've been, I mean, it all becomes convention and eventually. I've been reading recently physicists, cosmologists who they for some reason, their particular hubris is they like to, they think they're preachers. A lot of times they like to get into the metaphysical rather than merely the physical, but they will blatantly say, Dr. Manoj, that life itself has to be simply the mechanical result, a rather convenient mechanical result of physical processes, and it cannot be explained in any metaphysical way whatsoever. I even read one recently saying the question, what is life, is meaningless because life is no different than any other physical set of circumstances that we find in the universe.
Yeah, you get people like Lawrence Krauss or Stephen Hawking who will proclaim that, you know, metaphysics is dead, that the only way to discover any kind of truth is through science. Now, this is something that I think would have horrified Descartes himself because he is a rationalist, and he certainly stands up for the dignity of the soul. He may create this difficult mind-body problem, but he certainly shows in his arguments there's something very, very different about the mind in its subjectivity, in the nature of thoughts, than about anything in the world. And this is something we should assume before we do science. See, what's happened today is that by claiming that everything that we know can be reduced to this materialistic science, we have scientists who don't realize you have to have a first philosophy, which is what Descartes was doing, because you first have to have an account of how it is that human beings are capable of knowing the world. And if you turn human beings themselves into no more than machines, then you no longer have a clear distinction between subject and object. You can't account for the fact that we can think about things. We have intentionality. You can't account for the fact that we can reason about the way things must be, because all the things in the world just happen to be. And yet when we follow ideas logically, we can see that things must be the case. And that authority of reason, as Thomas Nagel says in his recent book, Mind and Cosmos, can never be accounted for just by the contingent interactions of human beings and their environment. That'll tell us what is so and what has worked. It'll never tell us what must be so. So you need an account of what human beings are and how they know. And you need to be careful then that the later claims you make about science don't undermine that, because it would be a real self-contradiction if you would use science to show that science is impossible.
Finally, how would you summarize it with about a minute or here, the strengths and the weaknesses of this philosopher we've discussed, René Descartes?
Greatest strength is the beautiful clarity of his writer. The two greatest philosophers who are also clear writers are Plato and Descartes. You have lots of murky ones. Aristotle, difficult to read. So is Kant. Hegel, very difficult. Beautiful style. He does show, I think, successfully there's a rational limit to skepticism. You just can't doubt without a doubter. And you find, therefore, that some forms of skepticism will reach a natural stopping place. He does consider objections and replies, and he's set the agenda, I think, for philosophy of mind today. Even though most philosophers of mind today are rather hostile to him, they're still dealing with questions which he opened up. I'd say his weaknesses are he relies so much on reason that he tends to be confined to what he can prove in that fashion. And so you end up with a God of the philosophers, a very rationalistic approach. Let's suppose one of his arguments for God's existence succeeds. We're still a million miles from Christ. We don't have God revealing to us who he is. We just have the existence of a deity. As well, in his dualistic account, you have these two realms. And although he says that a human being is a union of mind and body, he doesn't really have a holistic picture. We are a unity of mind, body, and spirit, it says in 1 Thessalonians, and we need an account of how all of those fit together in one person. And he doesn't really solve that, and he doesn't really solve the interaction problem, how minds and bodies relate, and that became a thorny issue for just about all of his successes, some of whom went to the crazy extreme of denying that they did interact. They're just on separate tracks. And so he created a lot of problems there.
And next time, what philosopher will we take up?
Next time, we will jump to an empiricist, so we'll take a look at John Locke.
Dr. Angus Manoogue is professor and chair of the Department of Philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. Dr. Manoogue, thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back, Terry Mattingly of GetReligion.org will be with us. We're going to talk about how the media has covered a massive wedding, 20 couples, that Pope Francis performed recently at the Vatican. Stay tuned.
Streaming 24/7 sacred music and talk stations from a 500-square-foot office in Collinsville, Illinois, you're listening to Issues Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, coordinator for stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.